Nature and Role of Scientific Knowledge, Part 3. The ninth talk in a series on Foundations of Knowing the Truth was presented by Charlie Dewberry on January 21, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center and Institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Dewberry's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Okay, this is the third week of looking at the nature and role of scientific knowledge. What I'd like to do is quickly review where we've been the last couple weeks. The reason is I've kind of been trying to juggle three or four things in the air. And tonight I'm going to try to bring them all down together, and hopefully they won't all end up all over the ground somewhere. So the plan is to try to draw all the pieces together that we've been talking about the last 2 weeks and somehow fit them together in a picture. So that's what I'm aiming at tonight. The first point is that traditionally, when most people think of science, what they think of is it's characterized by a method. And I've made a few comments about that, for instance, that I'm going to try to convince you that's not true. And I'm going to try to convince you of that by using the paradigm case that all scientists will want to point to, and that's the Copernican example. And then last week we looked at the traditional model and the differences between what I have called our ordinary way of knowing and then the traditional view of the method of science. And we noticed last time that there's really two places that there are differences, and the rest of the time we can find really corollary places. The first one is the traditional method denies that there's pre-understanding involved. It denies that we use our worldview or our biases, because that's the purpose of the method, is to set aside all our pre-existing, preconceived notions. And I'll talk more about that tonight. The second place was down here. The method that we validate a possible candidate is true. Over here, validation can take a lot of different forms. One, it could just be a thought experiment that, that makes sense to me. In some cases, we would accept that as a method of validation. Or secondly, we might set up an experiment, and if we pick an experiment careful enough to differentiate some cases, we might in fact come to the conclusion that we thought that our view was true. Or we might actually set up an experiment or something to validate it, and we find out it doesn't work at all, so we reject it and it's false. On the other side, in the traditional model, as I portrayed this, the traditional model believes you can only falsify. You cannot actually prove anything true. So you can just continue to test and look for cases where you can reject a hypothesis. And as long as it's not rejected, then you'll continue to hold it. But scientists who hold this model will be very careful to claim that they're not saying it's true, but that it's only been severely tested. And you'll find that all the time. Just watch the newspaper or read scientific journals or whatever. Scientists in this that hold this model, that's the way they're going to talk. They'll never claim that science can tell us anything that's true. They can only claim that they haven't rejected it yet. Well, and what I want to do tonight is, now I want to get down and I want to really evaluate this so-called unique method. And the context for evaluating it is going to be, as I said, the paradigm case that all scientists want to point at is the foundation of modern science, and that is the Copernican Revolution. So what I want to do tonight is, first, I want to come back to this notion of the Copernican model, and I want to look at it in a little more detail, and then once we look at it in detail, we'll take that and we'll put it back up here in these models, and we'll see what happens. Because The traditional view that I got in most of my education was, well, when Copernicus came along, the Ptolemaic model was really on the verge of collapse. And Copernicus saw that it was on the verge of collapse, and by using this scientific method, he swept away this old view that was largely lodged in religious circles. It was theologians primarily who were against Copernicus. And so kind of the common view, if you will, is here's the rise of modern science. Whatever Copernicus did, that science. And so I want to take a look at that tonight, because it is the paradigm case that almost all scientists and almost all philosophers of science are going to go to and show that whatever method they're talking about, that's what Copernicus did. Because, see, the issue that's raised here, again, is something I said before, is really, what could be more simple? You know, we've got 6 or 7 balls, and the question is, what goes around what? What could be more simple? And if we can't answer that, how could we answer anything complicated? And so one view is going to come to the conclusion that Copernicus was warranted in claiming his system was true. The other view is going to claim he was not. Now, as I say, the common view you usually get is that Copernicus was warranted in claiming his system was true, and it was the dogmatic theologians who rejected his view. That's what I was taught in most of my education into grad school. As I looked at it, I found that it wasn't quite as simple as I thought. And so what I would like to do for a few minutes is I would like to work our way through what Copernicus actually said for a few minutes. And I would like to work our way through what he claimed he was doing, step by step, and then he gave his justification for claiming his view was true. And let's take a look at that. And then we'll look at our models. Okay, Copernicus starts out in Book 1, and our translation of his book is called On the Revolutions. And he gives us several reasons why beginning to work on the question of the movement of the stars and planets in the heaven. He says, first, I was impelled to consider a different system of deducing the motions of the universe's spheres, for no other reason than the realization that astronomers do not agree amongst themselves in their investigations of the subject. They can't even agree on the length of the tropical year. So they couldn't even agree on what a year was. In determining the motions of the sun, moon, and planets, they do not use the same principles, assumptions, and explanations of the apparent revolutions in motion. For some use only homocentrities, others use eccentricities and epicycles, and they do not reach their goal. Those using epicycles get better results, but it contradicts the first principle of uniform motion. Okay, the technical terms, I don't want to go into all of them, but I do want to point out what an epicycle is. Everyone, since at least Aristotle, who had worked with astronomy, believed that things in the heavens move in a circle. And so all orbits of things in the heavens would be a circle. And Copernicus believed that too. And so the problem is as you watch a planet move, it will move towards the east, and then all of a sudden it will kind of swing down a little bit like this, it points, and then it will go off this way. And that's why the Greeks called them planets, meaning wanderers, that they would wander across the sky, and there seemed to be a weird pattern that they moved in these strange motions. Well, the problem is, as I say, since Aristotle, uniform circular motion was the motion of everything in the heavens. So the assumption was you've got to account for everything by circles. Well, how do you account for a planet doing this? Well, the way you do it is you got a planet going around a sphere here, but then you just put another circle on it here. And so the planet's actually going around 2 circles. It's going around a little circle here while it's going around a big circle here. And that gives us this epicycle. So see, that's the hypothesis, or that's the explanation that both Ptolemy and Copernicus are using to explain why the planets don't go around in this homogeneous, truly circular motion. So that's what an epicycle is. And I'll mention epicycles a couple times, so I wanted to talk just a minute about what that was. The next point is, they could not elicit or deduce the true structure of the universe and the true symmetry of its parts. So he's saying that, okay, there's a bunch of different models out here and people are making all kinds of predictions on how it goes, but people are using all different kinds of systems and they're getting different kinds of results at points. And his point is that they're not in a position to deduce the true structure of how things work. So anyway, then he reread past philosophers, and many had proposed that the earth moved. So it was not a new idea. It had been around since the Greeks. Come up several times, including Cicero, Plutarch. Anyway, then he goes on and he worked for, I've forgotten how many years, but it's almost a decade. And suddenly he claims he figured out that this is true, that the earth goes around the sun, all the planets actually go around the sun. Now, why did he think his theory was true? Here's his quote. "Having thus assumed the motions which I ascribed to the earth later on in the volume, and by long and intense study, I finally found that if the motions of the other planets are correlated with the orbiting of the earth and are computed for the revolution of each planet, not only do their phenomena follow, but therefrom, but also the order and size of all planets and spheres in the heavens itself is so linked together that in no portion of it can anything be shifted without disturbing the remaining parts of the universe as a whole." So what he's saying here is that, look, if you take this view and put all the planets in it, it just makes so much sense. It's just so rational that this is how it would be. And it explains all the phenomena. And they're just going around the sun. And you can't move any part of this system and have this stay together. And that's the basis that Copernicus is claiming, that his theory is true. Now, what I'd like to do for a second is, if that seems a little strange to you, that he might make that kind of claim, I'll point out that when Copernicus's book was tried, here's what one of the main theologians who was an astronomer said, who wrote to another theologian that was involved in the case, and this is in 1615. "If there were a real proof that the sun is in the center of the universe, that the earth is the third heaven, and that the sun does not go around the earth, but the earth go around the sun, then we would have to proceed with great circumspection in explaining passages of Scripture which appear to teach the contrary, and rather admit that we did not understand them than to declare an opinion to be false which is proven true. But as for myself, I shall not believe that there is any such proof until these Copernicans show me." Now, what was this churchman demanding as proof? He was a good churchman. He was an Aristotelian. Aristotelians demand empirical proof that your hypothesis, your theory is true. The church was demanding that the Copernicans give them empirical evidence that separates out these two cases. 10 years later, at his trial, Galileo, when asked what his empirical evidence was, he tried to give an explanation from the tides. Well, it doesn't work, and it's wrong. So that's what he tried to give as empirical evidence. But near the end of his own trial, he said himself, "I can't help but admire those Copernicans who believe this system true in spite of the data of their senses." And Kepler, 30 years after this, he had no specific evidence that this model was true, but he said, "Look at it. There's something that's got to be in the sun. There's something in the sun that controls this whole thing. We know that's true. Whatever it is, the sun is the key to understanding the solar system, not the earth. So the planets go around the earth because the sun is the center. The sun has this force, it's this light that controls the solar system." Again, no empirical evidence. So what we have here when we look at it is the Copernicans are claiming to know this system's true. And the church is asking them for empirical evidence, and there is none to be given. Now, let's look for just a minute now when we come back to our model of science. Well, first we have a hypothesis. We make deductions, now we test it. And these tests are going to be empirical experiments. This is our model of what science is. And so it would seem to me that if a scientist holding this view of science comes to this kind of case, they would all have to side with the theologians, that the Copernicans were not warranted in claiming to know their theory was true. So when we look at this situation, it's, I think, very interesting, because Firstly, what we know about the situation is that there wasn't any empirical evidence between the two. Secondly, the story goes that this is a simpler model than this one, and that there were fewer epicycles in Copernicus's than there was Ptolemy's. Well, when you actually work it out, it's not true. In fact, Copernicus might have a few more. And see, part of the problem here is the data was very sparse, and it wasn't really good data available at the time. Lastly, both systems would yield equal predictability. So if what you were interested in making predictions, both of them would yield the same results, empirical results, basically. And what's interesting is even today, for a lot of uses, the Ptolemaic equations are still used because they're simpler for a lot of stuff. So those things, I think, are also a piece that we have to keep in mind. So now, what I hope I've raised here at least is, if we're going to hold this as a picture of the scientific method, can Copernicus be considered the father of modern science? And I don't see any way he can, because the method he did is not fundamentally this one, in the sense of that he's not doing any tests, he's not doing any results, he's not doing any falsification of a hypothesis based on any empirical evidence. In fact, his justification is a very different kind of claim. His claim is, this is just so rational that that's why this is true. Now, that's a very different kind of claim. Now, what I'd like to do for just a few minutes now is say, you may kind of think I'm alone in throwing rocks at this kind of method, and I've been accused of throwing a lot of rocks at this method over time. There's parts of this that are very right and very true, but what we're talking about is the method as a whole. Is that in fact what scientists do? And that's what I'd like to talk about for just a minute. My claim that I'm going to try to convince you of tonight is this isn't really what a scientist does. I'm going to make a different kind of claim. But before I do that, I want to say that really, see, I'm not alone. And at first, this was just my reaction against this, that it wasn't making sense. But what I'd like to do for a few minutes is take you through where philosophy of science has gone in the 20th century and looking at this model. So that's what we're going to do next for about 10 minutes. And I don't want to get into a lot of details, but there is some very interesting pieces, I think, in 20th century philosophy of science that have a real bearing on this question. At the beginning of the 20th century, the main model, if you will, that philosophers of science had, and actually many scientists as well, was a view called logical positivism. And on the back, I outlined a little bit of additional information about logical positivism. A paradigm person who held this view was a guy named Ernst Mach, and we mostly know of Mach from the Mach number, and he was a physicist. And he started out by rejecting Newton's physics. And the reason he rejected Newton's physics is it wasn't empirical. You couldn't test it. So where Mach started is that what characterizes science is, first, there are no metaphysical concepts in it. Any word you use, it must be able to be tested empirically. So, an atom. Has anybody ever seen an atom, touched an atom, smelled an atom? No way, said Mach. There are no atoms. Those are metaphysical constructs that have no place in science. Secondly, science is inductive, meaning you just start out with data pieces. You start out with little experiments, and you're just linking them together in bigger and bigger generalizations. And so a theory is nothing more than, say, a summary of a bunch of data. And a theory can't say anything more than just in your individual data pieces. So questions like the ultimate nature of reality are empirically undecided and are therefore not decidable and they're therefore not science. So any kinds of questions that are outside what you can empirically test, those are not science. Okay, so here's his method. The scientist begins with observations. They notice generalizations and continue testing. If one observation disproves the theory is then rejected. And a theory has no persuasive power beyond its empirical evidence. So there can be no claim made for any theory past any empirical evidence. That's where the 20th century started. And logical positivists have claimed that Einstein's relativity theory is a paradigm case of their model of how to do science. Now, that's been challenged, but they claim that basically all the big findings of science in the early 20th century all can be accounted for in their model, and that's what scientists are actually doing. Well, starting in the 1930s, that view was critiqued by, first, a guy named Karl Popper. Popper's critique is basically what I call the traditional model. So this is Popper's model for how science works. Now, and I've talked about it for several weeks now, and this is still the one that's primarily taught in, well, I say primarily, it's still, certainly you can still find it in most textbooks, even at the graduate level. But in the last 10 years, there's been a shift. Starting, yeah?
So the traditional model is Popper's?
Yes.
And it's a critique of the
logical positivist.
So how is that model different?
How is that model, meaning logical positivist, different?
Right.
Well, first, you do not have a hypothesis. You start with data and observations. Okay, so their method was these 4 points that I had on the back. That's logical positivist. That's what the scientific method is to a positivist. Okay? Now, Popper said, no way. And that's the one we looked at before. You basically have a theory, and the hypothesis comes out of a theory, and then you make your deductions, and then you're testing. So you have a theory, and then you're testing portions of your theory, and these are the successes of science. And then at some point, you can put forth a new theory, and you can begin to test and come up with more positive cases. And this part right here, the successes of science, that's the progress of science for Popper. And so this is the model that's basically used by most everybody. Now, in the late 1950s, there are really three people who, I would say, so successfully critique the logical positivist view that no self-respecting philosopher of science has held it since. No one could be found after 1959 or 60 who believed logical positivism, and very few could be found who believed Popper. And these two of the three most influential books are Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions and Polanyi's Personal Knowledge. Now, what's interesting is Polanyi came first, and Polanyi is really totally forgotten about, which it will be clear why he was quickly forgotten about in a minute. But Polanyi starts out, and I'm just going to read like 4 or 5 sentences. This is the preface to his book. He starts out, "This is primarily an inquiry into the nature and justification of scientific knowledge. But my reconsideration of scientific knowledge leads in a wide range of questions outside of science. I start by rejecting the idea of scientific detachment. In exact science, this false ideal is perhaps harmless, for it is in fact disregarded there by scientists. But we shall see that it exercises a destructive influence in biology, psychology, sociology, and falsifies our whole look far beyond the domain of science. I want to establish an alternative ideal of knowledge. It's very different from anything from the scientific method." Michael Polanyi was a chemist, primarily, one of the best chemists of the early 20th century. And most of his philosophy was done after a long career in theoretical chemistry. When he starts out, his preface, he just makes the claim and argues, I think, very clearly and successfully, that this notion that there could be detached, objective knowledge is just lunacy. It's just absolutely false. And I'll come back and give his explanation when we come back to Copernicus in a few minutes. But Polanyi kind of set the course going here. Kuhn's book came out 2 years later, and this has probably been the most influential book of the last 20 years in philosophy of science. And in fact, it's read in a lot of different departments and disciplines. I think probably everybody has heard of a paradigm, and a paradigm shifts. Those are the words of Kuhn. So the whole idea of paradigm and paradigm shift came from Kuhn. Well, quickly, here's Kuhn's view. Kuhn also rejects this model. But Kuhn's rejection goes like this, that science starts out with what he calls a paradigm. And see, a paradigm determines, A, what questions are interesting. It sets the domain. B, a paradigm tells you what methods you will use and equipment. C, it tells you how to go about solving. So see, a paradigm sets up all these kinds of things. So to Kuhn, what science education is see, all scientists who go to college, they really go to college to learn this paradigm. That's what they're indoctrinated in, and that's Kuhn's words. You're indoctrinated into a paradigm. There are certain questions that are going to be interesting to you. There's certain methods and equipment you're going to use. They're going to teach you how to go about solving it. And there will always be these paradigm experiments. That here's the experiments that are the classic examples in this paradigm of how to do science. Now, according to Kuhn, that this is the way science normally operates. The scientist is educated in this paradigm. They do all their work in this paradigm, and they're basically solving puzzles. That, see, you've got this paradigm, and what you got to figure out is how to get all these pieces into this puzzle. And so what science really is solving these puzzles, these intricate little puzzles. And the better a scientist is, the better puzzle solver he is. He can take the cases nobody else can get into the paradigm, and he can somehow find a way to get them in. That's what scientists are really doing. And so ingenuity in science is learning how to get these puzzles, solve these puzzles. So for Kuhn, if you have a piece out here that you can't solve, that you got some kinds of situations out here that you can't get into your paradigm, that speaks badly of scientists. See, it's not that these out here are a ticket to something else. In normal science, as Kuhn's talking about it here, what this does is speak badly about scientists. They just can't figure out how to get these pieces into the paradigm and into their picture. But what Kuhn points out is, over time, a lot of this kind of baggage, pieces you can't get in, start accumulating over time. And after you accumulate a whole bunch of this kind of baggage, you start to get nervous. And so what happens is, usually some young Turk comes along who hasn't been indoctrinated his whole life into this, and so he hasn't gotten so brainwashed that he can't get outside of it, that this young Turk will come along and point out a new way, a new paradigm. So he'll start out with new questions, new methods, new ways of doing things, and it will solve some of these problems. And then scientists... Now, this is not a logical process because it's a conversion experience to go from one paradigm to the other, because there's no way to compare them, because you got nothing in common to compare them. They're looking at different questions. They got different methods. They got different ways of evaluating whether or not something's true. So what Kuhn wants to say is, look, it's a conversion experience. It's not logical. It's not rational. You're just going to go with it. And you're either going to get converted or you're not. And if you get converted, you'll suddenly see the world this new way and start doing this. Or if you won't, you'll sit up here. And for Kuhn, if you look at a lot of science, often at these points of crisis, is waiting for all these guys to die off. Because they control all the presses, they control all the journals, they control all the dollars. So science is waiting for these guys to die off. And then the new young Turks take over with their new paradigm. Now, Kuhn would use anything as an example. Darwin's an example, Newton's an example, Einstein's an example. I mean, he uses them as paradigm cases of what he's talking about. And for folks who work in science, there's certain things that ring somewhat true. Well, yeah, and Copernicus is a paradigm that Kuhn will point to as being, an absolute paradigm case. So... But anyway, he says that, see, the shift that's made here is not rational. I mean, because how could you decide this rationally? It's two different worldviews. So take Newton and Einstein. Newton says things are at rest. We've got mass. Well, Einstein says, mass. But he means something different by mass than Newton meant by mass. See, what Kuhn wants to say is even their language is a word he called incommensurable, meaning... There's nothing you can compare it to. They're speaking two different languages about two different things. There's nothing to compare. You either got to go with one or the other. And it's just not a logical or rational shift, but it's just a shift you go with. Now, where Kuhn ends up with this, and I want to wrap this up quickly, is that what Kuhn wants to say is, see, there is no truth in science. Because every scientist is stuck in a paradigm. You're stuck there. You can't get out of it. It determines what you do. And all you can say about this new paradigm is it's more evolved, meaning it came out of this paradigm. But you don't know if it's closer to anything or not, because how could you possibly know that? So this is more evolved, but there's no way you could say it's closer to truth, because the paradigm determines what questions you're going to ask, what methods you use, how you go about solving it. And so truth has been abandoned in science. And as I say, in the last 20 years, Kuhn's book is probably the most influential book that's been written. As I say, if you read anything in philosophy of science, Kuhn's book is it in the last 20 years. Now, in the remaining minutes, what I would like to do is come back now and take another look at this whole thing and see if I can wrap it up and see if I can bring all the pieces together. Firstly, the claim I was making in the beginning is what characterizes science is not its method, but I want to argue just its subject matter. That what I want to argue is I don't care what it is that we're interested in knowing. I think the model that I've outlined over here is the model that everybody's really using. So when a scientist goes out to do any kind of research, the scientist brings with him or her everything they think is true. For instance, if I'm going out and I'm going to do research on estuaries in Oregon, and I make a decision that I'm going to collect data at least twice a year, one during the summer and once during the winter. Well, see, there's a ton of stuff that already went into making that decision. Like one, I know summers are different than winters. I'm bringing all that with me. I'm bringing a whole bunch of assumptions. I'm bringing everything I know into asking that question. There is no way you can set aside everything. Say you're going to just start with observations. Well, why'd you pick those? You just pick up a beetle, and you pick up a bird, and you pick up a fish. Well, you're not randomly just picking observations. There's a whole bunch of stuff that went into picking your observations. They don't come out of the blue. And see, so the problem I want to argue is right here is the scientists and the philosophers of science who don't acknowledge this are making a big mistake. The reason they want to make this claim is they want to claim that scientific knowledge is more certain than other kind of knowledge because the method allows you to be detached from all this, and the method is tighter in its validation. Now, the second part, I think, may in fact be true, that one of the reasons science has been so successful is these validation techniques that are used down here work, and they do in fact work, but they're only part of the puzzle, and I'll explain that in just a minute. But I do want to acknowledge that a lot of the reason why science has been so successful is they have critically paid close attention to validation. And that has led to a great number of successes in science. Okay, so what I want to say is, first, this ordinary view of science is incomplete because, one, it doesn't include this. And two, I want to argue that its validation method is simply short-sighted, that it really isn't including all that we would want to include in validation. For instance, let me give you two quick examples. Let's say I'm looking at two papers in a journal. One paper says, all streams whose name starts with the letter S will function in a certain kind of way, different from all streams whose name starts with a letter other than S. The second hypothesis, or the second paper, is on that what happens in the upstream part of a river system has no effect on downstream reaches. Let's say those are the two papers that I'm looking at. Okay, in the first case, the paper actually has some data there that shows, in fact, that the streams they looked at whose names started with letter S are really different from all the rest. What would I do with that paper? I'll tell you, I wouldn't pay the time of day to that paper because I reject it offhand. I don't care what the data says. The second paper, in fact, this exists in the scientific journals. It's one of the most interesting papers I've ever run across. I worked for a number of years with a group that put together what's called the stream continuum hypothesis, which says what happens in the upstream part of river systems affects the downstream reaches. Now, two guys who I know very well did this research paper on organic carbon, and their study showed conclusively that what happened upstream had no effect on downstream results when it comes to organic carbon. Now, I'll tell you what, they can repeat this experiment 1,000 times, and I'm still going to reject their results because I'm not willing to set aside my belief that what happens in the upstream part of river systems has no effect down here. See, if you're going to be consistent in using this method of validation over there, those two papers would have to be evaluated the same way. And I would say no self-respecting scientist worth his salt would even look at those two papers the same way, and shouldn't. Because see, I think what's been neglected is that validation is simply not an empirical test. That what is at stake here is not just an empirical test, but much more than that. That it's got to fit with all of our pre-understanding as well. Now, okay, the last point I'd like to make now is to come back to Copernicus, because I think there's a piece that exists here that I find very, very interesting. And for me, it's the takeoff to, I think, a more complete view of what science is. When we think of science, for the most part, we think of empirical science, as we've been looking at the last couple weeks. But I think maybe you've seen already in the case we've been looking at with Copernicus that what's at issue is not really empirical evidence. The issues in resolving the Copernican revolution, at least at the time of Copernicus up till probably Newton, science, if it was done, the reason all those Copernicans held their theory was for some reason other than empirical evidence. And to me, that's an important aspect of science that ought not to be neglected. And it's been incredibly neglected, especially in the 20th century. And I'd like to come back to something that Polanyi said, because I think it's one of the most interesting things that I've run across in all of the history of science and philosophy of science. What Polanyi claims is when you look at Copernicus, and you remember Copernicus's claim that if you put it in his system, you can't move anything and keep it together, that his system just has everything in it, everything just fits where it ought to go, and you can't move any of it and keep this view together. Well, what Polanyi said is scientific discovery consists in embracing the vision of reality beyond the impression of our senses. So it's taking empirical data, a whole bunch of empirical data, and it's all of a sudden seeing them fit together. So the kind of experience that Polanyi is pointing at is, imagine yourself just sitting down somewhere and you're just confused. You've got a whole bunch of data and you just can't make sense out of it. And you're just wrestling with this stuff, trying to make it come together, trying to make it fit. And as you wrestle and wrestle and wrestle with it, all of a sudden, there's a picture. And you go, that's it. That it's taking all that mass of data and suddenly see it fit together. And what Polanyi is saying is that in our everyday lives, that's what we use. And the scientist isn't any different. That they're not just weighing numbers and evidence and that kind of thing, but there's a whole other level of validation that's going on. And the whole other level of validation is that it's taken all these pieces that are in our ordinary view of the world, it's taking all the data pieces that we've got, including our little experiment here, and it's putting them together in a consistent, orderly way. And if you look, that's what Copernicus claimed. I think that's Copernicus's claim for why he says to know his theory's true. So now in the last few minutes I have, I'd like to come back now specifically to Copernicus. If I'm right about what he's claiming, that is his validation for claiming his theory's true, should we believe him? Or did he just make a lucky guess? It's a very, very difficult question to answer. But see, I think ultimately the tough questions of science, and actually the foundational ones that form the foundation of a paradigm, scientists don't look very close at those. Those are all givens. Modern biology, I've never seen anyone yet in any biology class I've ever taken who sat down and worked their way through what a species is. They're all givens. They're all just part of the paradigm. See, all the foundational paradigms or foundational big picture part of sciences are all given from somewhere else. Then you do your little work within those. But see, to me now, I've learned that the real science, the real fundamental questions that are of interest in science are in part largely philosophical, as much as scientific. And Copernicus would be a paradigm case. So now, we'll come back. Copernicus is just saying that his system is just so rational that you just got to believe it. That it's so rational, it's put him in touch with the reality of God's creation. Those are Copernicus's words. Now that he's just, his view just matches onto God's view of the universe. That's his claim to know his is true. It just fits. That's the way it is. Now, as I say, the church, they were the good Aristotelians. They were the good empirical scientists, and they said, no way. With no empirical evidence, you have no right to claim your theory is true. So, as I say, where we sit is, where is the foundation of modern science? Let's just take the Copernican example. If we're going to be good empirical scientists, there is no way we can claim science began in astronomy until at least Newton. What Copernicus did, what Galileo did, what Kepler did, that could not be recognized in science today as the scientific endeavor. So I find it very interesting that the paradigm case that that scientists and philosophers of science want to point at is the Copernican example. Because actually, I find that it doesn't support their case at all when you look at the facts, I think. The facts support the view that's over here that I've really presented as our ordinary way of knowing. And so I think for just the last couple minutes, I'll just wrap up by just kind of real quickly then going over the 4 points that I've listed as far as the lessons to be learned from looking at Copernicus. One, the usual explanation given that Copernicus replaced a tottering system on the brink of collapse with a simpler, more true system, that simply will not do. That isn't what happened. And if Copernicus is the father of modern science, which I think he is, then that typical view that we get is just not true. Secondly, the traditional view of science is not complete. It's very good at explaining how certain kinds of techniques can be used for validation. But I think it's myopic. It doesn't recognize that validation of a theory is a very, very difficult kind of process that isn't just decided by lab experiments. C, while science attempts to establish a method which gives greater objectivity, it has not yet been successful. What I want to argue is no philosopher of science or no scientist at this point has come up with a system that actually establishes a method by which you have greater objectivity. Several have claimed to, but they've all been rejected. They've all been shown to be short of that goal. Third, as I said, I don't believe there is a unique method for science, that what characterizes it is its subject matter, that is, knowledge about the natural world. So at this point, I'll stop here and ask if there's any questions or anything we want to talk about. Yeah?
Could you go over your objections to the Kuhn model?
Oh, objections to the Kuhn model. Okay. Yeah, I didn't do that, did I? Well, the objections, I think, to Kuhn's model are, one, what determines what science is what a community of people do. And if you're not in the community of people who hold the prevailing paradigm, according to Kuhn, you're not a scientist. So, for example, if you work in a biology department and you're not working on punctuated equilibrium or a molecular, biological, genetic view of biology, Kuhn would say you're not doing science, you're not doing biology. Because it's the community. There's one prevailing paradigm that's going to be dominant. That's science. Whatever that community does, that's science. So that's the first objection. Yes, he agrees with that. No. So for Kuhn, what science is determined by the community. Secondly, I think there's an awful lot of truth in Kuhn about that, that a paradigm is basically learned and taught, and that's what people get plugged into, and that's what you do. If you want to go anywhere in science, that's what you do. But I don't think in the end that's determinative. See, Kuhn wants to claim in the end that, see, that really determines what you can see. So putting it in our terminology, what Kuhn wants to say is, your pre-understanding, your paradigm, is going to determine what you see, and you can't see really anything else, other than you'll acknowledge there's a few differences down here. But you're just not going to see anything else. Your primary objective is to try to solve these puzzles. Because, see, Kuhn is really ultimately a skeptic in that you can't really know what's really true. That's where it comes to. That's my primary critique of Kuhn, that he has abandoned truth. That there is no truth in science. So that's the major critique. For Kuhn, it's what a community does to, I don't know, make money, survive, have fun. I mean, it's fun to be a puzzle solver. There's tons of people that make their living solving puzzles.
If you criticized any of these methods, though, couldn't the argument be given like, well, look what we've progressed through it?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there sure has been progress in science, and I'll be the first to acknowledge it. The only question I would have is what method was actually used to give us the progress? And what I'd argue is, if you really got inside the person's head, it was over here. Pretty much, I think, most all the way. And the more people I read over here that have done those big kinds of experiments and who have outlined what they worked on for 20 or 30 years, you find they're over here, pretty much. It's not difficult to see them over here at all, and it's difficult for me to even figure out how to put them in this kind of picture.
But how do you argue the truth of what they've come up with? If you wanted to use evolution, you could say, well, gee, I don't think that doesn't fit in with my pre-understanding.
Well,
but progress shows that we're probably right.
Well, okay, let's just use the Copernican one. You know what the current view is? Current view is Ptolemy was right. If you really understand the implications of Einstein's theory, Ptolemy is right. He's at least as right as Copernicus, meaning you can set your reference point anywhere you want in the universe and just spin the whole thing. It doesn't matter which point you pick. So Einstein's point is Ptolemy was just as right as Copernicus. So if you want to be consistent in the 20th century now and go back to here, if you buy Einstein, then there's no difference between Ptolemy and Copernicus. Or at least, let's say you can make them. So they're empirically identical, according to Einstein's theory. So what's true? You believe the Earth goes around the Sun. Why? See, in the 20th century, we got no reason to. 20th century physics tells us there is no reason to believe that. But see, I think there is. I agree with Polanyi. And what Polanyi said is that we have this innate rationality that we put the pieces together beyond the data of our senses. And when we get this rational picture, what we're getting is correspondence to what amounts to the mind of God or reality itself. It's put us in touch with reality itself. That's a hypothesis that's been rejected over the last 500 years totally. No, I don't think so.
Does it require some scientific methodology to give more credence to the facts in a paradigm shift? Can you combine the two? Can you take the best of the scientific method and say that paradigm shifts occur with great thinkers who've used parts of methodologic examination,
mm-hmm.
and with those thought processes came to eureka, came to the opportunity to fall into place?
Can you do that? Possibly, but Kuhn would argue you couldn't. I mean, so all I want to say is Kuhn's argument is you can't. Because let's say you're looking at Newton versus Einstein. Pick terms, mass. Can anything be at rest? Da-da-da-da-da-da. See, you can't take any one of those pieces and put it in the other system because it's incommensurable. It doesn't fit. So Kuhn's point is there's no way to do that because you're talking two different languages, even though you use the same words. Mass for Newton is not mass for Einstein.
Is there any mathematical proof that supports Copernicus? And can you use that information?
No.
To support his theory, his presentation?
No. The same math can be used to support Ptolemy. Math won't solve this problem. There's nothing in math that'll help us solve the problem. You just have two different models.
As you're exploring the downstream influence of upstream activities, and you were setting up an experiment to shine some light on that subject, is there some way that Charlie Dewberry would utilize the scientific method of collecting data